This is Joshua David Bellin, author of the young adult science fiction adventure Survival Colony 9, and you're listening to Comic Pop Library.
This is Richard, and we're with Nathan Ferrugia, and this is Comic Pop Visits, and brought to you by Comic Pop Library. April's still here with Luis and Logan, and Nathan's still here. He's still able to visit with us for a little bit longer today, so that's why we're going to two parts. So thank you for doing this with us, Nathan.
I'm in it for the long haul.
Well, if you need to go, let us know. We're gracious enough. You're doing this for us. We definitely want to make sure you stick to your schedule if need be. But we'll get back.
As long as you guys can, you know, listen to me.
Okay.
Rant on.
That's all right.
That works for me. I'm still awake. So, and for everybody out there, we didn't mention this the first time about the time difference, but Nathan is in Melbourne, Australia, and we're in Lakin, Kansas. So we're talking about Monday night for us, about 9 o'clock. And for Nathan, it's probably Tuesday, about 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock, yeah.
2 o'clock. So that's why there's a little bit of why we're kind of a little tired on this end, but we're going to stretch through it. And Nathan said that he would be gracious enough to come back at a future date as well and talk about his third book, which is out. All three books for the fifth column are out, but his third book is Phoenix Ascending, correct, Nathan?
So many now, I don't even know myself. The Phoenix Variant was the third one, yeah.
Ascending was the short story.
Yep,
okay.
That's the one.
And we need to mention that if you are interested, you could go onto Amazon. I'm not sure if there's any other jobbers out there. Nathan, you might have to answer that, but Amazon has
his short
story.
What, sorry?
Any vendors that have your short story beside Amazon on the ebook edition?
Pretty much anywhere that will sell ebooks will automatically be there. You know, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Google.
Okay.
Sony, if Sony still even do that, I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
So if you're into the second book and getting ready to do the third one, there is a short story that's connected to the third book, so you might check out your ebook vendors and find that as well to read along with it. But we're continuing on. We're talking about Chimera Vector primarily and a little bit of the second book, Seraphim Sequence. I think I pronounced that right.
Yep.
The first episode, we kind of talked about the publishing industry and the book a little bit. This one, we're going to try to stick mainly with the books. And we talked about the characters in the last one with the main characters, with Sophia and Nasseria and Dane and Jay. I'm pulling this
Damien
off.
Damien and Jay,
Damien.
Yep.
I'm pulling this from memory, so forgive me, Nathan. One of the characters that... I can't remember the scientist's name, but I know Denton is one of the lead villains, I guess you could say, that is part of the fifth column, part of not. You kind of have to read into the series to kind of understand that.
And he does have his bits of hero-ishness in the second book.
And we kind of mentioned that your characters kind of have hero tendencies and villain tendencies, even your I mean, all of them. And you said earlier that was kind of just a happy accident, or you didn't realize you were doing that. Was that correct?
Yeah, I didn't realize I was, you know, pushing it that far. And that's pretty much the only, you know, main thing that if someone didn't like the Chimera Vector, unless they didn't like the genre and they were reading it by accident, that's also, you know, that happens too.
And like, apparently,
you know,
I
it's unrealistic. It's not, you know. But, yeah, I think the main thing is the main thing that some people found was some of the characters just seemed to be changing sides so much, and it you know, it made them loopy, I think. So, yeah, I think I pushed that to the extreme in the first book, and that was accidental in the sense that I didn't realize they came across as jumping sides so much, particularly Damien and Jay in the first book. I can give that away. but, yeah, no, it's something that, you know, I do on purpose naturally throughout the series. I don't like anything to be too black and white. I don't go to that extreme anymore unless there's a reason for someone to change sides. I think, you know, particularly with, you know, longer form stories, you can gradually have people shift, right, you know, good or evil, or faction to faction. It can be quite interesting.
And if I remember correctly, the first one's Damien and Jay was a false shift, wasn't it? The second shift they had?
The second shift?
Yeah, when they were back with Fifth Column for a bit, it was a false shift.
Oh, they were trying to infiltrate it.
Yeah, somewhere. If I remember correctly, it's been a fair good while since I've read the first one.
And I think that's what catches people out is if you're not, you know, paying attention at a certain point, you can quite easily miss that was false. I think that's where people go, whoa, what's going on, you know? So, you know, and that's very interesting for me to get that feedback.
And I actually didn't notice the rapid changing thing either.
Well, it's probably good, yeah.
Yeah, that's good storytelling.
That's how it should be.
It's good storytelling when you don't know what's going to come at you. But on the characters, you know, first books are always a little bit more hard to get into because you got to develop everything. But once everything was established, that was one of the uniqueness factors that I liked of the books and the series in general, is you don't know what's going to happen. And you don't know what sides they're going to have to fall on. So to me, that was a uniqueness factor that I hadn't really come across too often and enjoyed.
Oh, good. So, yeah.
But
and I'm always pleased to hear that.
And with the Fifth Column being the underground government, kind of similar to that, but it was the mind-bending stuff and the mind control and the shifting. I really enjoyed that a lot. With the characters, do you have a Bible set up or when the characters are going to show up, or is it a natural progression and then you just add those characters to the mythology? Because like DC comes in the second book, I believe, primarily. I don't even know if he was in the first book. So was he?
No,
already,
he wasn't.
Okay. Was he already planned out, or is that just a natural progression and then you weave it into the fabric of the story?
I can tell you that nothing in the second book was planned until I actually started plotting it. and that's because the first book had gone through so many cycles that all of the ideas I had for the sequel got completely scrapped over so many years that when I actually sat down to write the sequel, I thought, I don't even know what I want to do anymore. So, yeah, no, DC wasn't planned. Pretty much nothing was planned until I sat down to plot it. So, you know, now I think more about that, you know, in the future of who to bring in where and all of that. And I am thinking more ahead. But for those three books, I was really running off the cuff, at least before I sat down to plot it. I like to plot things fairly thoroughly and structure them and everything. I actually spent, I think with the Seraphim sequence, I spent 2 months plotting it and 1 month writing it. So I spent more time plotting it.
That's a fast ride.
Which is, you know, well, the beauty of that is that there I spent, you know, I didn't have to stop and think too much about what was going to happen. Things change along the way. You go, oh, that's a better idea. I'll do that.
Right.
But yeah, plotting, you know, helps me a lot with that. But until I sat down to plot it, I really didn't know who was going to come in where or what was going to happen. You know, it's always weird bringing in new characters. because they seem to come out of nowhere, and they because they do, you know, you've just introduced them. And particularly with DC, you know, it starts and you have some characters who already know who he is. So, yeah, it's a challenge as a writer to get that across. And so the reader doesn't feel like, oh my God, I missed something, you know. Did I miss a book in between or, you know. In fact, it's, you know, it's interesting. The challenge with the second book is how much do you explain from the first? And I actually think I over-explained a few things in the odd paragraph here and there. And, you know, maybe you guys noticed it recapped just for a little paragraph something that happened. And if I was writing that now, I probably wouldn't even do that. I just have to be brutal with backstory and not, you know, not relying on previous, you know, previous stuff too much. It's great okay. for, you know, readers who've read the first one because it just refreshes their memory. Right. But if you haven't, which some people haven't, they go into the second one. That happens all the time. It can be a problem, you know.
Right.
And a lot of people write standalone books in a series. They work as standalone, like Jack Reacher books.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah. I completely forgot your question, actually. I just went off.
That's all right. With Sophia, you kind of had to give a little bit of backstory for that second book, because the way the first one ended, and spoilers if nobody's read it or anything, but she basically became the villain almost, because what she did, didn't she sterilize pretty much everybody unintentionally?
Mm. Well, she was told she was going to sterilize them, but apparently that meant to the person who was tricking her that they'd kill them, while she thought it was just unable to birth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that how
they were talking about different versions of sterilize?
Yeah, she was tricked. She was thinking she was doing something that, you know, the sterilizing thing is a little morally
iffy.
You know, it's in a gray area there already, or forcibly stopping people from having children. There was a good reason behind it, but they didn't have a choice in that. So that was already right. a moral gray area. But what was really happening was obviously far worse. But the resistance group did it the, you know, that was averted to a degree. I won't go into obviously much more detail for anyone who hasn't read the first right. one, but you know, I wouldn't say she became a complete villain. And it was unintentional anyway.
Right.
She was manipulated.
But she does make that comment, you know, she within the very first part that, you know, she didn't know if she was willing to go on because of what she did. So she had to kind of rectify herself a little bit. So it showed that you were paying attention to the first one and continuing over into the second that, you know, there's ramifications. It's not just cut and dry. She can move on without any feelings. So, because when they start out, they pretty much don't have feelings.
That's right.
So there's that progression as well. And the mind control aspect and the trickery and everything, I mean, that is where, to me, the first one kind of, sometimes I had to reread some stuff to make sure I read it right. And it's not that it was written that I didn't enjoy it. It was just like, did I read that correctly? So sometimes that would lead me to where, okay, let me know what's going on, please. That's why I said you screwed with the reader's heads a lot sometimes. So sometimes that's a good experience. Sometimes it's kind of frustrating, though.
Yeah, it's striking that balance is pretty hard. I mean, you know, the one recurring theme with all of the books, I guess, is rectifying what they've done and, you know, dealing with all of the horrible things that they have done, if they are ever able to balance that. But it's interesting the point you bring up with the complexity of the technology in the Seraphim sequence, the second book, compared to the first. You know, it sounds like you found the second one a lot easier to absorb, you know, what was going on. It was a lot less complex.
Right.
Yeah, and I think the first book, really, I was cramming a lot in there. I wouldn't say too much, but I think it was, you know, there were certain points that if you just glazed over at crucial right. points, you'd be in trouble. And, you know, ideally, you want to avoid that. You don't want to have to rely on the reader paying you know, having 100% attention and being completely awake right. whenever they're reading every page. That's not part of the enjoyment. So, yeah, there was a lot of complexity in the first one. You know, I like to think I distilled a lot of the science down to really simply, so, you know, you could understand it, but I'm not surprised, you know, if you come across something and you go, oh, I didn't quite get that. Hopefully it's explained again later, and then I'll understand, you know, without repeating yourself too much, of course.
Well, I think with the first books on a series that I know is a series, I always look at that as the character development. So to me, it was like, you know, there's going to be those instances, and you have to explain everything with the science and all that. And then going into the second book, it was already there. So it was easier in that regards. But the science end of it, we know you have a military background and everything, but how much research did you have to do to bring in, because almost everything's viral related. So how much science background did you have to research to bring all that together?
A lot. That's my answer. That's obviously not in my expertise whatsoever. So, you know, it's an essential element. You know, you're writing a story that has military in it and science. You know, it's a popular mix, but how many people out there are experts in both? You can't be. So, but luckily, I have a good friend in New York, and he is really knowledgeable. He's a scientist, and he works in he knows a lot about he was the one who suggested to me, I was asking him, you know, look, I'm looking at these different ways of how you could augment people. This is for the first book even.
Right.
And you know, I don't want to do it in the same way that other people are doing it. I mean, one of my influences is the Deus Ex game, the original video game.
Okay.
If any of you know that.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites. and they use augmentations, and they use nanotechnology, which has been reused in so many games and stories and movies since then. I think they even worked it into Spider-Man at one point. Not the reboot, the movie before. I don't know. I'm sure it's been in the comics several times as well. But, yeah, I wanted to do something different. He said, you know, well, one way of because what I liked was the latent genes and all of the junk DNA, you know, and junk DNA has been used a lot too. That was particularly used in, I think, Heroes, the TV series.
Okay, yeah.
They talked about, I think they talked about junk DNA for the first half of the season. I like to call it pseudogenes, which is actually another name for it. And I think it's kind of the more proper term for it. Genes that we don't really know what they do, but you know, this is usually put across as, hey, you have all this junk DNA, but it's not really that. Like, some of this junk DNA probably already does something, we just don't know. So right. It's not completely inactive. But he said, you know, one really probably the best way, the most reliable way to turn on certain genes at the moment, and this was actually used, and I think I've used it in my books as though the fifth column did this very early on, you know, but this has really happened. There was a scientist in Japan who activated genes in a boy using a virus as a vector. They would inject it and they would deliver it inside, you know, the empty shell of a adeno-associated virus they found was the best type of virus that would spread through, you know, all of the cells in their body quite quickly. So that was the best way to replicate that through their entire body. And he turned off some of the genes that were causing muscular atrophy.
Okay.
I don't remember what his disease was. So that was actually a real event that happened, I think, in 2003 or something like that. So I made the fifth column do that in 1985 or something, you know, because they're always ahead. You know, so he suggested that to me, and then I went ahead and worked in that direction. So it was really helpful having someone point you through the dark and say, no, this is actually going to be a good way to go. Saves me wasting my time in an area of research I don't know anything about. So, you know, I was lucky in that regard. I still did the research after that. I didn't rely on him for everything, but, yeah, no, he was really helpful to tackle the science where I don't have any training in any form of science whatsoever, in any scientific discipline. So, yeah, that's something you have to learn from scratch.
Everybody gets to do that when you're a writer at one point or another.
So, yeah, and so when you do write about things in general that aren't really your specialty, you know, they're not, you don't know a lot about the subject, do you try to stay true to research today, and you try to stay true to the real world in a sense, or do you have no problem with, you know, making it as it makes sense with the story?
That's a good question. That's something that really have to make the decision yourself. I write in, I write techno thrillers, so they're now to near future. So I've only got a certain amount of leeway. So if it looks like this could be achievable in the next 1 to 2 years, or pushing maybe 5 years, then I go, okay, that's acceptable. But I still want to know exactly how it would be done, even if I don't use it. And half the research I do never gets used, which is kind of annoying. But, you know, that's how you come. You don't know what you're going to use until you come across it, you know. And I like to find out how it would actually work, because you either need, I think as a writer, you either need to know everything or be so convincing everyone thinks you know everything. So you're always, you know, floating between those different places. And I don't like to talk crap if I can avoid it, you know, because someone will pull me up on it. And it's not just so that one expert reads it and says, ha, that's wrong. Which happens anyway. It's just so, you know, it is accurate. And one little tiny detail that you get wrong, it's nice if you can, you know, have a, you know, really have a good, you know, a genuine effort, make a genuine effort to make sure that's accurate. At the end of the day, if it's impossible to find out something, then you can stretch it a little bit. There's a little bit of, you know, elasticity there. But as long as you don't stray too far off and make really terrible mistakes, or things don't really quite work, you can start to tear up the plot, and the plot falls apart. And you know, that's one of the things that that's why I went through 10 drafts of the first book, was mainly to fix all of the plot holes that were in there. And when you're jumbling around with all of this science and everything else, it's so easy to screw something up and go, well, you know, this one little tiny detail, if that's not true, none of this story can work. But then at the same time, you have to sometimes make allowances and just bend the truth a little bit. But I do think some writers probably bend it a little too far, which is okay depending on what they're writing, but
right,
they sometimes take a bit too much artistic license. So really it comes down to decision, and, you know, making a decision as to how far you want to stretch it, and also how lazy you are. Obviously, if you're more lazy, you're probably going to end up stretching everything out everywhere, and it can get a bit messy. And then you just run risks. That's all it is in the end. So I try to keep it as real as possible, but make the allowances where they count, you know, where it makes it more interesting.
So those messy times happen when you're in your bathrobe and eating Cheetos or something, and just it's a lazy day.
That's right.
Kind of on the same lines of what April said with the science, with the military aspect of it again, with the weapons and the utility vehicles. I know you have some of the fingerprint recognition, which is kind of still being worked on to a degree and actually out there, but on some of the weapons, have you created some of those yourself, or are they still try to be grounded with what's existing right now?
I think I know what you're thinking of. I mean, look, the mind control stuff is obviously a bit out there, and that's probably as far as I can, you know, it's push it. And look, you know, there are things in like the Phoenix variant that probably push things as far as I ever could. In fact, you know, you'll find they might be the most outrageous in terms of where you push that. But in the Seraphim sequence, you know, there is a weapon called the Vortex Ring Gun.
Right.
Which is actually, it's actually a real thing. It's not quite as portable enough that you can make it like a grenade launcher attachment to a rifle or carbine. But
okay,
it actually exists. And I think it was, You know, one of my main points of inspiration is DARPA, because they're like the mad scientist division of the Pentagon, and they have a lot of short-term projects like that that probably might be deployed if it's useful in the near future. And then they have really crazy stuff, like they've got mind control projects, you know, how to use synthetic telepathy between soldiers and that kind of thing. Like, these are longer-term projects, but they're looking at this crazy stuff, like, you know, just to see if we can do this, and maybe one day we can. You know, they're not, they're really out there with their with what they do. So I use DARPA, a real world agency or organization, I guess, as inspiration, and it comes across looking really science fiction. So it's a weird sort of, I'm stealing from reality to create science fiction, and then people think it's really way out. But the Vortex ring gun, for example, is something that's very real. And I think is intended to be mounted on vehicles and be used as a much larger weapon. But I like the idea of it being mounted onto, you know, a portable weapon. It's almost like that Jedi ability where a Jedi Knight can put their hand out and throw someone away. And to do a military real-world equivalent of that was really cool. Mm-hmm. Didn't waste, I guess they don't waste ammunition when they use it. But yeah, I don't know if that's what you were thinking of when you were mentioning it.
Pretty much. And to go with the Star Wars reference, you must be a fan.
Boba Fett kills someone.
How fun was that sequence to write in the second book? Because having Jay that used the Boba Fett figure to kill somebody?
I think it was Damien. Yeah.
Was it Damien? Okay. How did that sequence come about?
I'm trying to think now, actually, whether...
I know he was in the department store type area.
It was in like a... Yeah, it was in a grocery store. Yeah. And I was actually... Because I've been to... And this was set in Manila in the Philippines, and I'd actually been there, but I don't think I've ever actually walked into a grocery store. So I was Googling online all the different fruits they have and how everything's different and everything. And I think I came across all these different cereals, because I was looking at all these different things he could throw on the ground, you know, to use as not obstacles, but, you know, to be slippery or, you know, to work with him.
All right.
And I was looking at cereal for some reason, and I think one cereal had Star Wars figurines, and I just thought I'd have to find a way to include that. I didn't know how until I got to that very end, and I won't explain it how. Find out for yourself. But I just had to be used some way, and I think I found, you know, one of many ways to use a Star Wars figurine in combat. So.
That's fine.
So are you a Star Wars fan as well, or that just happened to be what came to?
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm assuming you guys have talked about the because at this time we have the trailer was recently released for the new one.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
There's been
go ahead.
The soccer ball droid kind of threw me for a moment. I don't know what else to call it.
The robot.
Yeah, it looks like a soccer ball with the head floating on top of it.
I thought that was cute. It's hard to tell at the moment, obviously, but I don't get any bad feelings from it, so
that's really, really good.
I think it looks too brand new.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think they should have gone... I don't mind them coming out with a new one, but I think they should have gone complete old school, and whatever technology was or was not available to them... When the originals came out, should be what they use for this one.
Oh, you mean production-wise?
Yeah, just in general, like,
well, it looks kind of for me like half
shiny.
And half.
Looks
it
too
looks,
shiny.
You know, for me, it looks like they used half and half. You know, original trilogy with the CG stuff from the new. I guess
we'll see.
I guess it's sort of hard to fight the urge to use, you know, a lot of the new stuff we have in something like that, which we didn't have back then. So,
true.
You know, it was easier for story to rise to the top, I think, than it is now. So this is why we get so many convoluted you know, action movies that probably aren't as enjoyable as that. But yeah, it'll be interesting. We'll see. True. Anyway, I'm sorry to sidetrack and start talking about Star Wars.
We sidetrack all the time.
That's all right.
You've heard us. We sidetrack a lot in our podcast. Probably one of the other things I just have to mention and get your how you came about doing this, but I made mention in the podcast where we talked about the books that you put your team, I mean, anything that can go wrong does go wrong, and even more will go wrong, it seems like. I mean, you put them through the ringer. I mean, how did that come about? You just hate your characters?
That's a good question.
It's like any battle they're in. Of course, they have the power, you know, they can
heal to a certain extent.
To an extent, but they get some vicious stuff happening to them.
I think it starts out fairly basic and straightforward, and then I get worried. It's too obvious.
Too easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that happens a little bit in plotting and a little bit in actually writing it. I throw a curveball in. I don't plan it. I just think, oh, what if this happens? So, yeah, some of it comes out of nowhere. Some of it's planned. It's hard to say. I certainly don't set out to try to make everything as disastrous as possible. But, you know, I just don't like it when, you know, these heist plans in movies, everything just goes perfectly well. And then they just have that one obvious thing that goes wrong, where in reality we all know. You know, especially the more technologies involved, the more likelihood something will go wrong.
True. So, that is
true. It just seems more likely that would happen. That's as I see it, if that were happening in real life, you know. But it also, you know, it keeps things interesting. So,
well, I think that's going about do it, unless any of you guys have anything else.
I'm good.
No.
Again, like I said, at the front of when we... Sorry. I'm sorry, Logan.
Have any of you asked the question, was the weather thing one of the earlier versions of what the second book could have been about?
No, that was just playing around with a common conspiracy theory, you know, which, and that one was a reference to HAARP, HAARP, which is, you know, it's a very common conspiracy theory that these antennas are used to control the weather. But when I looked at that and I looked at all the other frequencies they operated at, I thought, no, there's much more interesting stuff you can do with this. You could screw the weather. Why would you need to screw with the weather? It's already screwed anyway. So, you know, do something more interesting with it. But it's a very commonly held belief in, you know, alternative conspiracy communities, and which I enjoy, and I love conspiracies, but I also love, you know, subverting them and playing around with them and doing something different that's not, you know, that's not expected. Yes, because you see quite a few stories, whether they're novels or TV series, that draw on conspiracy theories. And, you know, I think once they become, you just don't want to do the same thing, you know. I won't be writing about a fake moon landing or something like that. But, yeah, you know, that was playing on a common conspiracy theory and turning it into something different, something that's probably a little bit more likely, I guess, than manipulating the weather. And that's, I don't think that was a DARPA project for once. So there you go. That was an exception. But that wasn't an earlier draft. That was just a play on, you know, on conspiracy theories. And because you see, I'm particularly aware of things like, you know, Dan Brown made some conspiracies quite popular. You know, he did the whole Illuminati thing, and I just think, right. You know, that's been done to death. Secret societies are such a common, they're almost a trope, I think, in a lot of types of thrillers. And just having one little secret society, you know.
Right.
So I tried to avoid that and do the fifth column instead, and the psychopath angle as well, which is, I guess, more genetic, really. So
right.
Rather than just do the same thing that everyone else does and either use an existing or create a new secret society that's controlling everything, it's, you know, it's kind of boring. So, yeah, it's I like to be aware of conspiracy theories and know, you know, where I want to go in that territory and where I don't want to go. So yeah, that's why the weather was in there in the Seraphim sequence.
And we know when we do our recording for the third book, you'll be bringing some other stuff into it. So that'll be explained at a future podcast. And Nathan's been nice enough to say that he would be willing to join us when we actually do that podcast. So hopefully everything will work out where we can get back together and do that as a tag team.
Yeah.
And hopefully we haven't given too many spoilers. I think we kept it pretty much spoiler free for the first two books.
No actual plot for the second one.
So hopefully everybody that's out there, pretty much any of your e-vendors that you can go to on the internet, you can look up Nathan Ferrugia. Did I do that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to be second-guessing myself now, Nathan. you can pick up all three of his first books and also his small story that goes right. Is it in between or kind of in the book?
It can kind of go anywhere. I think my publisher has placed it as after book three.
Okay.
You could read it before, you could read it after. I thought it would be good to read it before, but I was corrected on that. So, you know, it's self-contained, so you can read it anytime, really.
And I think that's the
one that ties in with the third book, specifically, I guess.
I think that one was the Phoenix Ascending that I mistook for the third book's title.
The Phoenix Variant was
the third book. So if you're out there, look those up. I think if you're into the military sci-fi thrillers, you'll enjoy them. Even if you're military and not a big fan of sci-fi, I think there's enough that you hold back enough on the sci-fi that your general military readers will probably enjoy it as well, I think. So we want to give that plug out there. It's not stretched that far into the sci-fi universe, as you mentioned throughout the interview. So I think you can get both of those audiences involved. So look for those. Hopefully you'll enjoy them. We enjoyed them. I have definitely. Logan's liked them. We appreciate Nathan being here with us. We hope everybody enjoyed our two-part episode with Nathan. We've enjoyed having him here with us and visiting. Hope everybody's having fun out there like we've had. We'll see you on the next go-around.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Comic Pop Library. We welcome your comments and suggestions by emailing us at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. All emails submitted become the property of Comic Pop Library and are subject for use in our show. We would also appreciate it if you would spread the word about Comic Pop Library by posting about us on Twitter, Facebook, or just tell someone about us. This podcast is not endorsed by any publisher, distributor, or studio, and it is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The views and comments of the show hosts are their own and are not reflective in any business, entity, or organization associated with ComicPopLibrary.com.